This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. Well, it is that time of the year again. No, we're not talking about the holiday season. We're talking about year end. That's right, folks. What are we on the day we're doing this? And probably the day you're listening to this, you're probably going to have only about 3 weeks left to consider any tax planning you're thinking of doing to lower what for most individuals is turning out to be their biggest tax bill. So we're going to talk about year-end tax planning in general. And just to make you aware of, as many of you know, on the 2nd of January this year, Congress passed a new tax bill. And folks, there's a lot more to this tax bill that people are not familiar with. It's not just people making $400 or $450. Believe it or not, you could be losing itemized deductions. You could be losing exemptions. You could be paying extra Medicare tax and extra investment tax. And we're just getting started. There's a lot more to this bill, and we're going to cover that and some of the things that you can do to minimize that.
And I'm John Lefter, sitting in for Vacationing Kathleen Harris right now. You know, two of our favorite spy and geopolitical thriller novel authors both died from prostate cancer, Vince Flynn and Tom Clancy. So this is obviously an issue among men. And our guest today on Lifetime Income will be the author of You Can Beat Prostate Cancer and You Don't Need Surgery to Do It. It's Robert Marchini. So we're looking forward to that one. You know, as Jim said, it is that time when you're thinking about year-end tax planning. Typically, people get tangled up in the vacation holidays between Thanksgiving and Christmas and Hanukkah and everything else going on. But that leaves you with very, very few days to do tax planning. Not a lot of days left, and sort of minimizing your options there. So we need to look at what could possibly be ways of reducing your biggest bill, your taxes.
And John, this year, this is going to be especially important because the President and Congress passed a major tax bill. And I don't think people really realize, you know, we heard about they brought back the Clinton tax rates. But folks, there is a lot more stuff that was added into this tax bill. And it's not just people making $400 or $450. It goes much, much lower than that. And it's going to impact a lot of middle class Americans, especially with husband and wives both working, where you can get into some of these brackets where some of these other things of the bill come into effect. So it's not just upper Americans. There are going to be a lot more people that are going to be impacted by this. Not to mention, John, as you know, the alternative minimum tax, which was designed to basically go against Larry Lotsabucks and the guys that made the mega bucks that were sheltering their income to make sure they paid at least a minimum amount of tax. Well, because they have not been raising the amount on which it's assessed and haven't indexed it to inflation, more and more middle-class Americans are moving into the alternative minimum tax, meaning that they're losing part of their itemized deductions, which in effect is raising their taxes.
You know, it's interesting, Jim, how when taxes always come in, even the income tax itself, remember the promise is that it's only going to affect people making over a certain amount of money. You and I can remember 1913, right?
You and I are both around there. It's amazing how good health we are.
When that was the promise, when they brought in the income tax, don't worry, it's just going to help us get through this rough time because we were plowing into World War I at the time and a few other things. And that was the promise. Well, before you know it, that level just came right on down. Originally, I thought, though, and I think this is the problem that people aren't thinking of right now. I don't think they're aware of these new taxes are going to hit them. But I did think that only higher taxes impacted couples, well, let's see, $450,000 a year married or $400,000 single. So you're trying to tell me that this is changing somewhat.
It's not changing, but there were a lot more things that were added into the bill. I mean, that was the kind of thing that made the headlines. Hey, anybody making over 400 single, 450, you're going to go back to the Clinton era tax rates. But John, they added a whole bunch of new taxes on top of that. They're mainly called tax expenditures. There's a whole list of things. For example, the one is the tax bracket, which is what you just mentioned, 450. If you are married, filing a joint return, 425. If you're head of household, and 400 for single. That's the one everybody's thinking about. But here's the other things that come into effect. There is another tax bracket that determines if you pay a higher capital gains rate, the capital gains rate going from 15% to 20. There's another tax bracket for individuals losing out their exemptions. There's another threshold for losing your itemized deductions. There's another one for an additional Medicare tax. And then there's another one for a Medicare investment tax. The net result is tax rates have gone from the top era Bush tax rate of 35% to a top tax bracket now of 44.6%.
Phil Mickelson at one point said he was in a 60% tax bracket, and he just basically figured it didn't pay him to work anymore. Remember, Ronald Reagan was talking about that way back when. He said back in the 40s, he said, you know, the government wants to take 93% of what it is you make. Why bother working?
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened. And you could see that reflected in Hollywood back then, that most well-paid movie stars, the Clark Gables of his day, they would only make one picture, because once they made over $100,000, basically at that point, the government took 93%, or it actually got up to 94% in 1945, and that's before California. So basically you're saying, hey, go work, and we're going to take everything you make. Well, the movie stars were saying, you know what, I think I'll take the time off. And that's what's happening. We're getting back to those rates again. We're almost up to 60%. If you look at states like my own, California, which raised income tax substantially last year, now we have a substantial increase in the tax rates at the federal level from all kinds of sources, not just the rates, the phasing out of exemptions, the phasing out of itemized deductions, additional taxes on investment income and capital gains.
You know, you don't realize that it is that flabbergastatively high until you do factor in the other taxes that are combined. Not to mention, by the way, Jim, all the taxes you pay on gasoline and sales taxes and everything else. The total amount that people pay in taxes are just staggeringly high. And your state now, of course, has 13.3%. That will be on top of the federal tax rate. So you look at that. I can see why Phil Mickelson wants to move, because it's not worth living there.
No, in fact, in his press conference, you know, he really had to think of how many tournaments does he want to play. He's almost better off, actually, quite honestly, doing what many athletes before him, like Tiger Woods, did. And Tiger moved to Florida because he figured, you know what? You know what? I'm going to have to pay the state of California. And that was, John, when we were only at a 9.3% tax rate. Imagine now when we're at 13.3. But you're right. In California, the combined tax rate, both federal and state, is 57.9%. So let's round it off and call it 58%, which is why we're seeing companies move out of California. We're seeing movie stars, athletes, businesses are leaving the state. And believe it or not, they're not done yet. Pelosi and Reid are wanting to raise taxes even higher by getting rid of itemized deductions for many working Americans. They're saying, not only do we want the higher tax rates, but once you reach a certain level, you're going to lose all your itemized deductions, which is what they're trying to work on. And that gets back to the Simpson-Bowles Commission that said, let's get rid of itemized deductions. But what they forget, in exchange for getting rid of what they call tax expenditures, which is basically an itemized deduction, they were going to lower the tax rates. They were going to have three tax rates with the top tax rate at 23%. Well, I'd give up my itemized deductions for a 23% tax rate. And you remember, John, Ronald Reagan.
You know, Reagan, remember the Reagan tax cuts, he brought things down to 28%, but that was in exchange for getting rid of itemized deductions. By the way, keep your eye on the VAT, because what they're going to do is, if they try to bring in a VAT here in this country, they'll say, well, we'll bring the income tax rates down. Yeah, that'll be for a year or two. And then you and I both know it'll both be high income tax plus a VAT tax plus state sales tax plus, 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 plus. If these exchanges aren't exactly this for that, you know that they're going to imply both of them.
Well, yeah, you're exactly right. I interviewed Martin Armstrong a while back, and he was in Dick Armey's office in the 90s when they were talking about working on a flat tax, which Martin Armstrong was proposing would have tremendous economic impact in terms of economic growth. And Dick Armey looked at him, he said, you don't realize, if we put in a flat tax and get rid of all these itemized deductions, then when they gain control, he was talking about the opposing party, the Democrats, he said, then they'll start raising the income taxes. And that's exactly what happened under Reagan. Reagan got rid of a lot of the tax shelters that we used to be able to, you know, John, back in the 80s, I could zero out my taxes in the month of December. You had huge real estate deductions you were able to take, all kinds of, yeah, the tax rates were higher, but nobody really paid them because you had all these various tax shelters and means of sheltering your income. Well, Reagan came in and said, we're going to lower it to 28%. We're going to get rid of these tax shelters. We're going to get rid of certain itemized deductions. We're going to place limits on this. We had the alternative minimum tax. And everybody said, okay, we'll give up that for the lower tax rate. But what happened? Bush number one came in, raised the tax rates to 31%. Then Bill Clinton came in a couple of years later and raised the tax rates to 39.6%. We never got those real estate deductions back. We never got the tax shelters back. We never got a lot of the things that we gave up in exchange for the lower taxes. And that's what Dick Armey was trying to explain to Martin Armstrong. He said, you don't understand the way Washington works. We'll lower this in exchange for another tax, but once we get the other tax and nobody really wants to pay, then we'll go back to raising the income taxes, which is proven throughout history, which is exactly what they've done.
Let's go back to the thresholds, because those are going to be of concern to listeners. There are six different tax thresholds where you lose itemized deductions. You know, previously, if you didn't make more than $400,000 single or $450,000 as a couple, you were generally safe. But I guess that doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
No, I mean, there's six different taxes that come into effect. Let's begin with the obvious one, which is what everybody was told about. And that is, when do you move into that higher tax bracket of 39.6? And remember, these are all progressive. It's not just that you move into a 39.6% bracket, but all of your income below that is also taxed at higher brackets. So it's not just, oh, we just bumped up the tax rate, you know, basically 5%. No, folks, that's not the way it works. The tax tables, once you reach 450, means that all of your income going back to the first dollar is taxed at the higher brackets, the old Clinton tax rates, where there were eight different brackets that you got hit. So the thresholds are $450,000 if you are married, filing a joint return, you move into the higher tax bracket, $425,000 if you are head of household, and $400,000 for a single individual. Now, if you're married filing separately, maybe it's a second marriage, it's $225,000, just take half the married bracket. So those are the tax rates. The second thing that they did is they also raised the taxes on capital gains from 15% to 20%, and they also raised the taxes on dividends from 15% to 20%. Now, the thresholds for the capital gains rate are the same rate for the income tax rates, $450,000 for a married couple, $425,000 for a head of household, and $400,000 for a single taxpayer. So the $450,000 and $400,000 tax bracket applies for the income that you earn and the higher capital gain and dividend tax rate. Now, let's get to personal exemptions. Everybody gets an exemption. The exemption is worth thousands of dollars, not only for you, your wife, but also each one of your children or dependents. Now, for that, they lowered the threshold not from $450,000 for a married couple, but they lowered it to $300,000 if you are a married couple, $275,000 if you are head of household, and $250,000 if you're a single taxpayer. Then, they didn't stop there, folks. So not only are they going to do away or phase out your itemized deductions, obviously the more income you earn, you could lose all of your personal exemptions. They also reduced your itemized deductions by 3%. And the thresholds for reducing your itemized deductions are the same as the personal exemption, $300,000 if you're married, $275,000 if you're head of the household, and $250,000 if you're a single taxpayer. Now, it doesn't stop there. Now, remember, we have the 39.6% tax bracket, but many of you are aware that if you work in the private sector, you pay Social Security tax. Now, once your income exceeds the Social Security limit, which is $110,000, you also pay a Medicare tax of 2.9%. If you are self-employed, that number is 2.9%. It's one half of that if you're an employee. Well, they added in an additional 0.9% to the Medicare tax. So the Medicare tax now is 3.8% if you are self-employed, and then it is one half of that if you are an employee. In addition to that, there is a additional Medicare tax on investment income. And for investment income, it's $250,000 if you file a joint return, $200,000 for a head of household, $200,000 for a single individual. So the key brackets, John, are $400,000 for a married couple for income taxes, $400,000 for capital gains, $300,000 for a married couple for exemptions and itemized deductions, $250,000 for the Medicare tax. And then for single, it's $400,000 for income and capital gains, itemized deductions, personal exemptions, it's $300,000, and then it's $200,000 for the Medicare tax. So all of that added up together can bring your federal income tax up to 44.6%, and that's before adding in any state income taxes.
Let's do some case studies because that's what we're sort of good at here on lifetime income. Let's take two couples. We'll say one in their 40s and 50s trying to save for retirement, and then a couple that is retired. How do they deal with these increasing tax bills?
I mean, if you take a look at the tax planning tools, they could probably be summarized in three basic categories: tax deferral. Now, if you think of tax deferral, think of your 401k program, a pension plan that you have at work. If you're a highly compensated executive, you might be talking about deferred compensation where they take part of your bonus. They don't give it to you. They put it away for you, and you get it later on when you retire. Or things like tax deferred annuities, where you can accumulate interest or capital gains in mutual funds without paying any taxes. So the first tool is tax deferral. The second tool that's available still is tax-free, and that mainly applies to things like tax-free bonds. And then the third one is what we call tax-sheltered. Believe it or not, you can still invest in real estate and shelter your income. You just can't get excess deductions and apply it as a write-off against any other income. So you can shelter the rental income you receive from properties. There's also things like pipeline companies and royalty trusts that are listed on the stock exchange where the majority of the income is considered a return of capital, so you don't pay any taxes on the distribution. So here's the thing. Each person is a little different. Now, if you are an employee listening to this program, the tools that you basically have available to you are to take advantage of any kind of pension program you have at work. Think of a 401k program. If you're highly compensated, you might want to talk to your employer about something like a deferred compensation program. This hits a lot of people, John, at the end of the year. You know, you get that nice bonus in December, and then you take a look at the check and say, oh my goodness, I got this bonus, but after taxes, I only have half of what's left after they take out federal and state taxes. So a deferred compensation program, a pension program, things like tax-deferred annuities that allow you to defer your taxable interest or your taxable gains and dividends, and then also dividend stocks, because the top tax rate is 39.6%. The top tax rate on dividends is only 20%. So you can see that the tax on dividends is half of what it is on ordinary income. Now, if you are an employer, if you're self-employed, you have a lot more options. For example, special pension plans that can shelter a good chunk of your income. And boy, I tell you, if you don't have a lot of employees, you're in your 50s or in your 60s, take a look at a defined benefit pension plan, because you can really salt away literally hundreds of thousands of dollars off your tax return. And also, you can get deductions, such as if you own your own business, you own your own office building, or maybe you're in manufacturing, you own your own manufacturing building, you can pay yourself rent and have a good portion of that rent sheltered through the depreciation of your building. And then also, you can run personal expenses through your business, whether it's cars, other kind of things that you have available. Obviously, a lot more things that you can do if you're self-employed versus an employee. And then finally, and this applies to any individual, and that's tax-free bonds. But once again, if you take a look at taxable investments today, you really want to be in the higher tax bracket to be in tax-free bonds. So if you're in a 44.6% federal bracket, 13.3% in California, a 3.5% tax-free bond yield here that's double tax-free is the equivalent of earning 8.3% tax-free. And the other thing you might want to consider, and I know Rob Bernard and I have talked about this on the program several times, is these royalty trust and pipeline companies where you can get 7 and 8% dividends. It's considered a return of capital, and that's equivalent to earning 12 and 13% pre-tax. So you can see here, John, the three basic tools are tax deferral, tax free, and tax sheltered. And then there's, depending on whether you're an employee or employer, different tax strategies that you can use to minimize those taxes.
How do all of these changes affect retirees? Any important changes or just pretty much status quo?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of it depends on the assets that the retirees have and how they're structured. I mean, there's personal assets, things that you own personally or in the name of your trust. If you were an executive, you might have a deferred compensation program, or if you worked at a company, maybe you had a pension plan, a 401k that you rolled over into an IRA. So personal assets, deferred compensation, and pension plans, all of those, John, have to be treated separately. And what we have found, you know, I've been doing this for almost three decades now, but we have found, especially with high net worth clients who have been very, very successful building up a sufficient portfolio that's going to allow them to maintain and they've achieved their financial goals, what they're going to find, if you look at a budget and you put together a plan, taxes are going to end up being their single biggest expense in their budget. Now, think about this for a moment. What other expense item on your budget can cost you up to 40 to 50% of your income every single year? Think about that. Not just one year, every single year. And I would venture to say for many well-off retirees, John, taxes are probably their single largest expense.
Is there any one strategy that sort of minimizes this impact, or is it better to try to use a combination of strategies?
You know, John, with high net worth individuals, we probably end up using a combination of strategies, and those strategies actually may change over time. For example, I have a highly compensated executive, and we specialize in highly compensated executives, especially where they have stock option plans. But in this particular case, there are going to be five phases to this individual's tax plan. Phase one is this individual has a deferred compensation program that has built up substantially over several decades working with the company. So the idea was to minimize the income taxes when he retired, because our goal when he came to us was to keep him under the $450,000 threshold where he would be bumped up into those higher Clinton-era tax rates. So we're going to take out his deferred compensation program over a 10-year period, and that will keep him below the $450,000. He had two options. One was a 5-year payout, and one was a 10-year payout. The 5-year payout would have put him in the higher Clinton-era tax rates. We are converting a good portion of his cash and personal assets into a laddered tax-free bond portfolio. The reason we're doing that is we're trying to minimize and keep him below that $450,000 threshold. And we are holding on to his company stock. It pays a nice dividend, but the company stock, the dividend will be taxed at a 20% rate versus his 44.6% rate at the higher income tax. Now, the goal is, at age 70 and a half, he is going to have to start taking out minimum required distributions from his IRA, because we rolled over his pension plan into an IRA, and we're going to allow that to grow tax deferred until he's required to take it out at age 70. What we're going to do is this individual lives within his means. He doesn't spend all the income that he has. So any excess savings are going to be poured into a laddered tax-free bond portfolio, any savings. So we'll just be building that tax-free bond portfolio with the idea of keeping him in a lower tax bracket. So that's phase two. Now, phase three kicks in once his deferred compensation program is fully paid out. Then we're going to convert some of those portfolios from tax-free into dividends, because dividends will be taxed at 15%. He's no longer going to be in that higher threshold that we're going to have to deal with the deferred compensation program, because the payout was rather substantial. And then phase four of his program is, as he continues to save, as we continue to grow the portfolio, especially the IRA, most people don't realize is an IRA could be subject to those 44% tax rates as well as up to 40% estate tax. So there's two taxes that come into play on an IRA. So phase four of his plan, John, is going to be to minimize the estate taxes in this estate, because this individual has assets that accumulatively will be eventually over $10 million, where the estate tax rates kick in at 40%, not to mention the 44% tax rate that is going to be taxed on his IRA. So his IRA could be subject to two taxes, 40% estate taxes and up to 44% income taxes. So phase four of his program is going to be minimizing estate taxes. We'll probably look at a charitable trust, maybe a foundation, depending on how big his estate gets. We'll also be looking at some various trusts for children and grandchildren in the gifting program. So, John, it just doesn't stop. In this case, there are going to be four phases to this tax plan.
Yeah, and so as you might think, no cookie cutter approach is going to work, you know, one size fits all. You have to look at each person's circumstances and then try to tailor a plan that properly evaluates their situation.
Yeah, you know, it's not enough to have a plan, but that plan, John, has to be monitored because, I mean, just take a look at over the last couple of years, we've had several tax law changes, income tax law changes, estate tax law changes, the markets have changed to bear markets, net worths change over time, and what may start out as initially an income tax problem in the case I just mentioned, if done properly, becomes an estate tax problem as the assets grow. But if you have a plan, you can work around these problems and minimize the taxes all along the way.
You know, the hard part about doing any kind of planning is that things in state capitals and our national capital are never the same, and the tax laws are this constantly changing pitching deck. How do you build that into your planning when, you know, you're never sure what they're going to cook up next?
Well, I think right now with the divided Congress, and especially if Meredith Whitney's thesis about the Central Corridor is correct, which is mainly red states, that's where all the jobs are moving. That's where manufacturing's moving. That's where population's moving. And, John, I think over time with census data, you're going to find more of those states pick up a lot more seats in the House of Representatives. And as long as we have a divided government, you know, we can keep the other party from raising taxes. So at least from the tax sources that we get out of Washington, D.C., we get a monthly tax letter. They're telling us that, you know, at least until after 2014, who knows what will happen in the congressional elections, but given the backfiring that we're seeing with Obamacare, and especially as this hits people hard next year, it's fairly safe, or at least they're estimating, that the Republicans will hold on to the House of Representatives, which means we have a divided government. So at least, probably, John, to after 2016, and who knows what happens after that, at least right now, the taxes that we have in effect will probably remain in effect. I really think that if they go after higher taxes in the future, they're going to have to do it sneakingly, which will be something like a carbon tax, which Obama wants to put in, and a VAT tax, which he also wants to put in. That's the two big things. They would raise so much more money than a higher income tax bracket. And those are the two that at least our tax people are telling us is what they're cooking up on the sidelines, trying to figure a way that they can sell that to the public and that would be good for the country.
Yeah, there's also a global wealth tax, too. I don't know if you've been watching this. I saw the IMF mention it. Now, there was an article this last week in the Wall Street Journal that this would be a one-off, pretty substantial tax on wealth to try to boost it, not just in the U.S., but they're talking about all of the indebted countries.
Yeah, you're talking about now is the IMF where Larry Summers talked about in the next recession, we'll start taxing people on their savings in order for them to spend the money. But also it was considered a one-time wealth tax of 10 to 25% on a person's wealth. What they wanted to do is basically take this one-time wealth tax, wipe out the government's deficit and allow the government to start spending money all over again.
Well, that's the other part. You know, there's a rule of thumb to get out of a hole, stop digging. But they actually just want to take care of the hole and keep digging.
You know, it's amazing. I was reading an economic report on Japan's economy last night, and they are raising the VAT tax to 8%. And what's happening is everybody was anticipating this, so a lot of people went out and spent money on things, bought things ahead of the tax going into effect. Now that the tax is going into effect, business is slowing down. And now they're going to have to come up with some tax deductions to encourage people to go out and buy cars. I mean, you know, government never gets it right. They never think this through. People aren't automatons. They are going to do what's in their best interest. And if you can minimize taxes, you're going to do it. You know, I was reading also last night on France's economy. Their unemployment rate is up. Their economy is slowing down. What do you expect when you raise tax rates to 75%? Manufacturing and companies are moving out. Same thing that's happening in my own state of California.
I think the plan is simple here. First of all, have a plan. Second of all, put the plan in place, design it, plan it, and then you have to monitor it because there are always changes in laws that are going on. But be proactive. That's the core issue. Don't just stay here and be hit by it. And I should mention, coming up next, Jim will be interviewing Bob Marchini on his book, You Can Beat Prostate Cancer and You Don't Need Surgery to Do It.
You know, John, when I heard about, of course, you and I know that two of my favorite authors were Vince Flynn. I love this series. He was working on another book. Unfortunately, he did not live long enough to complete it. But, I mean, he was diagnosed with prostate cancer at age 44, and I read in the jacket of his book, and 2 years before he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, he had a very difficult time sitting down writing for more than an hour, hour and a half time. And I'm thinking, boy, if something like that was wrong with me, I think I'd want to go to a doctor and say, hey, doc, something's wrong here. Check me out. But the other one, it was almost like, I think, 6 weeks of each other. First, it was Vince Flynn. And then, as I always do every single week, I'm always on Amazon looking for new books to read because I read a lot of books. And all of a sudden, I find out Tom Clancy died. I knew that he had had bypass surgery, so I thought maybe it was a heart attack, but no, it was prostate cancer. So I'm thinking, this is so preventable for men. So I went on Amazon and I took a look at the top books on prostate cancer. And Bob Marchini's book, How You Can Beat Prostate Cancer Without Surgery to Do It, is rated there at the top. So I'm looking forward to this interview. And for a lot of you men out there, don't end up like Tom Clancy and Vince Flynn. This is a preventable disease, just as same thing with breast cancer for women. They're almost like brother and sister diseases. You'll find this book very fascinating. It covers just about everything that you need to know to not only prevent it, but what to do if you've been diagnosed with it. That's coming up right after this. You know, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, in 2010, 196,000 men were diagnosed with prostate cancer. That year, 28,560 men died of it. Aside from non-melanoma skin cancer, prostate cancer is the most common cancer among men in the United States, and chances are, if you're listening to this program, you live long enough, you may end up having it and dying of it, not even knowing of it. What brought this to my attention this year is I'm an avid reader, and two of my favorite authors, Vince Flynn and Tom Clancy, both passed away of prostate cancer. And I thought to myself, how can these intelligent men, men who were well off, very smart, die of a disease that's treatable and detectable? Joining me on the program is an answer to this, Robert Marchini. He's written a new book called You Can Beat Prostate Cancer and You Don't Need Surgery to Do It. Bob, before we get into your book, I wonder if you can share with our listeners a little bit of your own personal background. You had a father that had prostate cancer, you had a brother, and you yourself had prostate cancer. I wonder if you can give us a little color of what led you to write this book.
Sure, Jim. As you know, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer about 13 years ago. Prior to that, about 2 years before, my brother had been diagnosed with prostate cancer. And he did what many folks do when they're diagnosed. He took his urologist's advice and he had surgery. I happened to drive him to the hospital that day for surgery. And he walked in the picture of health, and 4 hours later, when I was with him in the recovery room, he was in pretty bad shape. He had lost a lot of blood. He had tubes and drains and catheters in him, and he looked like the picture of death to me, and it really frightened me. I was especially interested, obviously, in his case because it was my brother, but also because my PSA at the time was rising. And I actually made a promise to myself in the recovery room with my brother that day that if I'm ever diagnosed with prostate cancer, that I'm going to do a lot of work, a lot of research, and find something better than surgery, which is a rather barbaric procedure. And I did, and it's called proton beam radiation therapy. But in the process of doing my due diligence, I did a ton of work. I call myself a recovering engineer, but I studied everything I could find. I researched everything I could research, interviewed doctors, went on the internet, and I discovered proton beam radiation therapy, and I learned a lot along the way. And in the process of doing this research, I gathered so much information. I decided that I was going to put a book together, basically the book that I wish had been available to me when I was diagnosed. And I decided to write it in layman's terms, but to try to cover as much territory as possible with regard to the diagnosis, the treatment alternatives, the pros and cons of each, and what men can do to both prevent prostate cancer and get themselves diagnosed at the earliest possible stage. So that's the background and history of why I wrote the book.
Why do you think, I know in the case of Vince Flynn, who passed away recently at age 47 this year, he was diagnosed with an aggressive prostate cancer at age 44. But reading into Vince's background, he was writing, and prior to being diagnosed, he couldn't sit down for more than an hour and a half at a time because of the pain. Now, you would have thought, Bob, that somebody with that kind of pain, it would trigger some kind of thought process like, gee, I need to go see a doctor because this doesn't feel right. And if he did see a doctor would probably at least explore, don't you think, the idea that maybe there's prostate cancer?
I sure do. What we don't know is whether or not he was seeing a doctor at that time. I have found that a lot of folks, particularly people who are busy, men who are busy, businessmen and so on, and if they feel good otherwise, they probably avoid seeing doctors. They postpone their annual physicals, or they might be having annual physicals that don't include the simple tests that are used to detect prostate cancer. So exactly what went on with him, I don't know, but it's not that uncommon. I've come across a lot of successful men, businessmen especially, who are diagnosed with a more aggressive disease primarily because they were too busy to go in and see their doctor.
Mm. Let's talk about, for those listening, if you're a man, what are the basic things that you should have done? I would think, Bob, we all know that we should have, as we get older, have a physical each year. When you have a physical, you have blood tests. What are the basic things? I would think an annual physical blood test where they measure your PSA and you have a DRE exam would be some of the basics.
Correct. It's actually quite simple. The PSA test itself, while it's not an indicator of prostate cancer, it's a relative indicator, if you will. You know, high PSA doesn't mean you have prostate cancer, and low PSA does not mean you do not have prostate cancer. But generally speaking, if a man has prostate cancer, usually he has elevated PSA, or more importantly, he has a PSA that is rising at a rate that is beyond the normal rate of rise for PSA as men grow older. And the second test that they can have done is the digital rectal exam, the DRE, which again is a very simple test. On the Today Show just recently, a couple of men that host the show had digital rectal exams, and they took about 10 or 15 seconds each, obviously behind a closed door, but just to show how simple and effective that test is. And once you have these tests done, if there are indicators that there's something out of line, then you go to the next step, which is a biopsy. But usually that's a last resort.
When you see these things are fairly common, I imagine it's the same thing with women with breast cancer, because breast cancer and prostate cancer are kind of like sister diseases. When you take a look at this, what happens? Let's talk about the biopsy, and let's say you want to find out further. Let's say you have a rising PSA. I know there's things like prostatitis, which is kind of like an infection. So when you have to go to that next step, what are the markers or indicators that would tell a man that this is what you need to do next?
Good question. And once again, it's a subject I cover in the book in some detail. And it was intended to teach men what they need to do to take control of their own health. So you start by having an annual physical. And during that annual physical, you have the PSA test, a very simple blood test, and the digital rectal exam. If there is a signal there that there might be something that's out of the ordinary, the next thing you would likely do is have something called a free PSA test. It's a test that determines how much of the protein, the PSA protein in your blood, is bound versus unbound. And if it's a low percentage of free PSA, then there's a much higher probability that there is cancer present. If the number is very high, then you don't have to worry so much, and you would probably postpone your biopsy. But if you start having multiple signals that there is something wrong, that's when you schedule the biopsy. And even then, you need to know what's going on, and you need to take control of the biopsy, because not all doctors do biopsies the same way. If I knew then what I know now, my prostate cancer would have been diagnosed 2 or 3 years before it was. They were only taking 6 samples, for example, back when I was being biopsied, or 8 samples later on. Today, I recommend a minimum 12 samples. I also recommend that you choose a urologist to do the biopsy that's going to have an assistant working with him or her, because that makes the process go more smoothly, and it takes much less time, and it's less uncomfortable. And I also suggest, again, I didn't know this at the time, but there are available medications, anesthesia, that can deaden the pain or minimize any discomfort during the test. So if you do all of these things, you find yourself getting diagnosed sooner, and the diagnosis gives you better information about the staging of your cancer so that you can pick the proper treatment protocol.
Now, let's say that you've gone through this process, you have a rising PSA, you go and you get a biopsy, and they find cancer. I have known men who have had prostate cancer, and I don't know whether it was being diagnosed or considering the options that was more stressful, because the first thing, at least from the clients that I have had that have been diagnosed, is they suggest surgery as the gold standard or typical radiation. So once you've been diagnosed, what's the next step?
Good question. The next step is to take charge of your treatment choice. If you happen to be dealing with a urologist, and it's usually a urologist who diagnoses your prostate cancer, you must understand that your urologist is fundamentally a surgeon, and urologists do radical prostatectomies. Now, they will explain to you that there are other options available to you, but most often, urologists recommend their specialty, which is surgery. What patients need to do is to educate themselves, and if you start doing that, once again, read my book because I explain these in great detail. You'll discover that there are two major treatment options available, surgery and radiation. But for each, there are multiple options within them. With surgery, there's open surgery versus laparoscopic surgery. With radiation, there are multiple forms of radiation, from conformal external beam to IMRT to rapid arc to CyberKnife, tomotherapy, brachytherapy, which is radioactive seeds, and proton beam radiation therapy, which is what I chose. And in addition to these options, there's cryotherapy, there's high-intensity focused ultrasound, and there's active surveillance, which is basically doing nothing if you have a rather indolent, slow-moving cancer, and let's say you're a person of advanced age. So you owe it to yourself to learn about each of these treatment options. And probably the best advice I can give anybody is, in addition to talking with the doctors and doing your research, is to interview former patients. I got my best education talking with men who had chosen surgery, brachytherapy, IMRT, cryo, and so on. And that helped me greatly when I had to make my decision.
Let's talk about some of the options, because typically when you go in, you see a urologist, they're going to say radiation or surgery. And then they might even suggest, well, we have robotic surgery, the Da Vinci machine. When you look at this, there are so many more options. Today, there's hormone therapy in your book you talk about. There's radiation seeds. There's regular radiation. There's proton beam. There's surgery itself. There's HIFU. Talk about some of the different alternatives that are available that, you know, many men listening to this program, if they've been diagnosed, may not be fully aware.
Well, as it turns out, if you happen to be diagnosed with prostate cancer, I think different from almost any other disease you can think of, the treatment alternatives are so disparate. People jokingly refer to surgery, radiation, and cryo as cook it, cut it, or freeze it. But they are so different from each other, and each of them might result in a disease-free survival percentage that is comparable to the gold standard, if you will. But they all come with different quality of life issues or morbidity or toxicity. What I discovered is that radiation cures cancer at least as well as surgery. And if you pick the right form of radiation, you can end up with a much better quality of life later. The typical side effects from any prostate cancer treatment can be impotence and incontinence, loss of bladder control, loss of sexual function. I was 57 when I was diagnosed, and neither of those things were attractive to me. So I focused heavily on quality of life after treatment, which is the reason I chose proton. But with surgery, either open or laparoscopic, there is a high probability of impotence and a moderate probability of losing sexual function. Less so with radiation. But even then, you need to pay attention to the important factors, such as the experience of the doctor that is performing the procedure and the side effects that typically come with each procedure. So there's surgery, there's radiation, there's cryo, which is liquid nitrogen, there's high-intensity focused ultrasound, which is destroying the cancer with heat. And of course, there's active surveillance, or watchful waiting, as some call it, which is just to keep an eye on your PSA and monitor it. And for early stage cancers, and in some cases, it makes sense to do it that way.
Now, when you go through these different alternatives, and of course, each doctor, or let's say even the doctor that diagnosed it, may have a particular preference that either they're a surgeon or they want regular radiation. Describe for our listeners the difference between, let's say, regular radiation and proton beam, because there are two distinct differences.
Yes. As a matter of fact, most forms of conventional radiation, such as conformal external beam radiation, IMRT, rapid arc, cyberknife, tomotherapy, they all use photon radiation or X-rays. And one characteristic of X-rays is that when X-rays are directed at the human body, they tend to radiate and therefore damage everything they come in contact with on the way into the body as they pass through the tumor volume target, and then on the way out of the body. That's the nature of photons or X-rays. When you consider the treatment that I chose, which is proton beam radiation, it kills cancer the same way by damaging the DNA and preventing the cancer cells from multiplying and dividing and staying alive. That's a process they call apoptosis, programmed cell death. The difference is that when they take a proton particle, which is the largest particle in the atom, and they use a particle accelerator to get it up to about 3/4 of the speed of light, and then they direct it to your body. What is unique about proton radiation is the proton particles pass into your body without colliding with healthy tissue, bones, organs on the way in. They slow to a predetermined speed, and then they release all of their energy at the tumor volume, which means that there is no exit dose. So you could have a Geiger counter on your right hip during treatment and have the proton beam coming in the left side of your body, and the Geiger counter would be reading zero because the proton beam is so effective at coming in, not damaging healthy tissue, and then releasing all of its energy at the target. The analogy I use in my book is it's like the difference between a cluster bomb, which will come in and destroy the whole neighborhood, versus a smart bomb that can be delivered to go down the chimney and just destroy the house. And if you're a male and you're talking about the prostate, and the prostate is surrounded by some very important real estate in the human body, it's very important that you're not having collateral damage done to organs, tissue outside the prostate itself.
Why is it that proton beam is less well known, and yet its effectiveness with fewer side effects, you would think that this would be more highly advocated by the medical profession?
Well, it certainly is less well known than conventional radiation. And to put it in perspective, when I was treated back 13 years ago, there was only one proton treatment center in the United States, and it was at Loma Linda University Medical Center in Southern California. Today, there are 11 functioning proton centers, with two more about to open in January and about another 10 under construction. So this is a treatment protocol whose time has come. Major cancer centers, MD Anderson, Mayo Clinic, University of Pennsylvania, and others are now building or have built proton centers. Johns Hopkins is in the process of building one at their Sibley Memorial Hospital in Washington, D.C. So the more of that that happens, the more widely this will be known and accepted. The fact is that the medical community has accepted that proton beam radiation treatment is far superior than conventional radiation for treating brain tumors and ocular tumors and pediatric tumors and so on. And for the very reason I describe, it tends not to do collateral damage around that target. The controversy has to do with treating prostate cancer. And since there are lower cost treatments available, there has been a long time disagreement as to whether or not the proton beam is more effective than conventional radiation, based on all of the information that I have, including three surveys that I've done of the members in my group, now close to 7,000 members in 35 countries. It has convinced me that proton beam radiation therapy is far superior to conventional radiation.
What about cost and insurance coverage? I know that insurance companies are getting more discriminating in terms of the things they cover today in terms of procedures and even drugs. What about coverage?
Well, the treatment itself, the technology is FDA approved and has been approved for many years. And proton beam radiation therapy has actually been used for about 60 years to treat cancers. Most of it in the early years was done in a physics laboratory because that's where the particle accelerators were. So for the past 24 years, it's been done in a hospital setting, beginning in Loma Linda University Medical Center. So it's a technology that is now growing and expanding, and a technology whose time has come.
We hear more and more cases about men getting prostate cancer. And I guess when you're a celebrity or a politician, you think of John Kerry, Robert De Niro. This makes headlines, even Warren Buffett. When you take a look at the experience that some of these men have, and some of it has not been good, why is proton, let's say, not more widely knowledge? You would think somebody of Warren Buffett's means or even John Kerry or people like that would be more aware of some of the alternatives. Is it because you think, okay, you take somebody like Bill Clinton or you take a famous Hollywood actor, they go to the traditional sources of medicine, they think they're getting the best treatment. In some cases, they're not getting exposed to the actual best treatment.
You're absolutely right. I think there are two or three reasons why celebrities, VIPs, tend to go with the more traditional treatments. And it's fundamentally because there are some big name physicians out there like Patrick Walsh at Johns Hopkins, who many consider to be the guru of surgery, that these folks have access to. So I think that there is a tendency for the big name physicians to be connected with the big name celebrities, VIPs, and so on. But there's another factor, and that is that in order to be treated with proton beam radiation therapy and most other forms of therapy, you need to go to the hospital to be treated. You're treated as an outpatient, but you're treated 5 days a week for roughly 8 weeks. And in order to do that, you need to make sure that you are in the proximity of this hospital during that period of time. So if you're a Warren Buffett or a Robert De Niro, Rudy Giuliani, and so on, the likelihood of your being able to do that is very low. So they tend to opt to something that is quicker and easier, such as open surgery or da Vinci laparoscopic robotic surgery. I think they're making a big mistake because the side effects connected with those quick treatments are far more severe than with proton beam. And I encourage people to take the 2 months to have the treatment that's going to give them a better quality of life for the rest of their lives. I should point out, by the way, that there are clinical trials underway at 3 proton centers right now using a shorter treatment protocol, 20, 24 treatments, so you can have proton therapy done in half the time. And I believe that will be the standard in the not-too-distant future. And I think eventually you might even find that proton beam radiation therapy could be done in something less than 20 treatments. But it's going to take some time in clinical trials to get to that point.
When you take a look at this and the fact that it's so prevalent, and I've read studies, Bob, that many men may die in their old age and have prostate cancer and may not even be aware of it. But just like breast cancer, we're becoming more aware. The disease is more commonly known, especially with men today, or breast cancer with women. So if you were to sum up some easy things that our listeners could take into consideration, if you're a man, for example, I was really surprised to find out about Vince Flynn because he was diagnosed at age 44. I mean, most men are told that, well, when you get in your 50s and 60s, you should have this checked out. That may not necessarily be the case. So if you were to break it down to some practical steps for a man, what would it be?
In my book, I talk about the 10 steps that men should follow to take control of their lives and their prostate health. And it starts with choosing your doctors wisely. You'd be surprised at how many doctors don't know much about the prostate. So choose your doctors wisely. Always get a second opinion if you suspect there's something wrong. Monitor your PSA on a regular basis, at least annually, once you're age 50 or older, or age 40 and older if you have prostate cancer in your family or you are at higher risk. Have an annual digital rectal exam. Have this free PSA test if you have elevated PSA or a lump by digital rectal exam. Manage your biopsy test. Evaluate all your treatment options if you have a positive biopsy. Talk with men who have been through the treatment. And then make a decision that's in your best interest, not your doctor's best interest. And if you choose surgery or brachytherapy, which is seeds or whatever, choose the best practitioner and the best hospital you can find, not the one that's closest to you because it's more convenient. You want to go to the best hospital and the best doctor. And in addition to that, I would say maintain your physical and mental health. Daily exercise, healthy diet, fruits, vegetables, and all the rest. All of these things are good for your health, but they're also good for preventing cancer, high blood pressure, and so on and so forth. And they also help to slow the progression of disease and strengthen your immune system. So those are the steps that I would recommend.
One of the reasons why we see this And I think this maybe has to do with male personality. You know, a lot of executives, actors, or even some of these well-known people that we've heard stories about, they're very busy in their life. So they don't have the time to, like I think of Vince Flynn, he's writing books. He can't sit down because he has pain, but you know what? He proceeds anyway to continue to work until finally he was diagnosed. But the other thing I think with men is that they choose treatments. It's kind of like, okay, I got it. What's a simple solution? It's kind of like our society today. We want a pill. We want something quick. We want something fast. Let's just take care of this and be done with it.
That's correct. There are many that fall into that category. I think we're doing a better job right now getting the word out on health and nutrition. And I know as I look at my own circle of friends, they seem to be much more aware nowadays of their health and prevention of disease and so on and so forth. I see them eating healthier diets. I see them paying attention to books and articles on health and sharing it through the internet, email system, and all the rest. So I think that's changing. Having said that, there are still many who don't pay attention to these things. Take a look at how many people are still smoking. Take a look at how many people are obese. We know that obesity promotes cancers of all types, including prostate cancer. We know that smoking promotes cancer, yet people still do those things. So it's a matter of just keeping getting the message out there, and hopefully people will start paying attention to their health and making the right decisions for themselves.
And one of the ways you can do that, if you're looking at a situation, maybe you've been recently diagnosed, or maybe you just want to keep yourself in good health, you're aware, maybe you have a family history of it, one of the best things you can do is get Bob's book. I wish you would have wrote it earlier, because I know some men, clients that I've had, that have made some decisions that they wish there would have been better alternatives. The name of the book is You Can Beat Prostate Cancer, and You Don't Need Surgery to Do It. It's by Robert Markini. That's M-A-R-C-K-I-N-I. And Bob, I believe your book is now available in Kindle edition, is it not?
Yes. Most people buy it through Amazon. You can get hard copy through Amazon or the Kindle version through Amazon, or you can buy it through my website, which is protonbob.com.
Well, listen, Bob, I want to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. And seriously, men, don't end up like Tom Clancy or Vince Flynn. Take care of yourself. And if you suspect something, make sure you get onto it right away. See a doctor, a qualified doctor. And if you do have something, do your homework, do your research. That valuable time you spend looking at the various treatment options could be the very best decision that will not only save your life, but also give you a better quality of life. All right, Bob.
Thanks so much, Jim. Good talking with you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You know, folks, we read about tragic stories, whether it's about Farrah Fawcett or, in this case, two of my favorite authors, Vince Flynn, dying at an early age without taking the proper precaution or taking the proper steps. Or even worse, people that make medical decisions that they regret later on in their life. If you are a man and you're healthy, I don't care if you're in your 40s, you're in your 50s or 60s, do some basic things. Go for an annual physical. Get a PSA, have that part of your test, get a DRE, and make sure that if you do have this disease, you catch it early and you don't end up like these two authors did, dying at an early age well before their time. And if you do have it, read Bob's book and take a look at the various options that you have. You have more than one option besides surgery or traditional radiation. What you're going to find is a better way to diagnose your disease, take care of it, and live a long and healthy life. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.